BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's Lucy Hockings in Brussels.
And it's Vitaly Shevchenko, also in Brussels.
It's 771 days since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And Vitaly and I are here in Brussels. We are sitting on a very nice, very comfortable, quite plush couch in the British ambassador's official residence. It's a lovely building, Vitaly.
It's opulent. There are lovely gilded decorations in the walls, lots of mirrors, lots of statues, ancient clocks and chandeliers.
Very ornate.
Very ornate, very pompous.
It used to be a hotel. I wouldn't have minded staying here back in the day.
Me neither, but it can't be further removed from the essence of what we're going to be talking about, the war.
Yeah, it's a bit of a special Ukraine cast, an important episode for us, especially for our listeners in the UK, because we are here to speak to the UK's Foreign Secretary, David Cameron. He's here in Brussels right now for the NATO summit. It's taking place as we record our pod. World leaders right now really expressing their concern about the possibility of the war spilling over into Europe because we're seeing an emboldened Vladimir Putin. And of course, there is this possibility on the horizon of a second Trump White House. So we wanted to ask David Cameron, we're going to ask him, what role can and will the UK play in supporting Kyiv? So, shall we do this, Vitaly?
Let's go, Lucy. This is Ukrainecast.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.
Ukraine is an epicenter of unbearable heartache and pain.
Millions of people are without heating, without water.
Putin is the aggressor.
He will be ready to use nuclear weapons.
They killed him and fled.
I do not know how we managed to survive.
I want people to know the truth.
Foreign Secretary David Cameron, welcome to Ukrainecast.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you.
So you're here for the NATO summit in Brussels. Some world leaders are now talking about the possibility of NATO forces actually in Ukraine. The prospect as well of war spilling into Europe. Can you at the moment rule out the presence of NATO troops in Ukraine?
Yeah, what NATO's looking at is a NATO mission for Ukraine, not a NATO mission in Ukraine. It's making sure that we use NATO's architecture to help deliver some of the support that Ukraine needs. But I mean, fundamentally, I think that we should do everything we can to help Ukraine. That's been Britain's position. And I think it's not escalatory to say we are going to help this independent, sovereign country to fight off an aggressor, and we're going to give it all the help we can in order to do that. And I think as long as you stick to that, it isn't escalation. And I would say Britain's played a really key role, actually, in proving it's not escalatory. Lots of people said, oh, well, don't give them anti-tank weapons. We did. It wasn't escalation. It was right. Lots of people said, don't give them long-range artillery. We did. It wasn't escalation. It was right. And same with the Storm Shadow missiles. We've helped Ukraine to fight off this illegal aggression.
But you don't see the prospect of boots on the ground, NATO boots on the ground in Ukraine?
No. I think that we don't want to give Putin a target like that. NATO can do lots of things to better coordinate the help we give to Ukraine. But fundamentally, for countries like Britain and all those supporters of Ukraine, this is a question of political will. Do we have the patience? Do we have the will? Are we prepared to give the resources? Now, Britain's case, definitely the answer is yes. We've given over 7 billion. We've trained over 60,000 Ukrainian soldiers in a program that goes back to my time as Prime Minister. We started that in 2014. And, you know, fundamentally, add up all the countries backing Ukraine. We outmatch Russia's GDP by 25 to 1. We've just got to make that difference count.
But for people in Poland and people in the Baltic states, they're really worried now about Russia attacking their countries. What is the plan at NATO and here in Brussels if the war spills over into Europe?
Well, we have Article 5. An attack on one is an attack on all. And those countries are NATO members. And one of the things, actually, I did as Prime Minister when Obama was president, was very visibly station British troops on the eastern flank, just as the Americans very visibly station American troops on the eastern flank. So I remember Obama saying, look, it's very important when Russia looks over the border into the Baltic states, they don't just see Baltic state troops, they see British troops, they see American troops, they see French and German troops. I think that's really, really important.
Is there a bit of an acknowledgement here in Brussels at the moment that the current plan is not working?
There's an acknowledgement that we've got to do more, and particularly those countries that haven't done as much as some should do everything they can. One of the pleas, I was in the NATO assembly yesterday saying, look, one of the things to do, and I know this sort of sounds a small thing, is go through your weapon stocks and see what you've got that you can give. Some weapon systems have an expiration date. They're literally a used-by date, as it were. Much better to give those to Ukraine and they can use them rather than have to decommission them at home, which actually cost you money.
Vladimir Putin will be in office for at least another 6 years. His troops are making gains on the battlefield. His main critic is dead. Arguably, Vladimir Putin is in the strongest position he's been since the start of the full-scale invasion. How much is the West to blame for this?
I would challenge that. I mean, Putin has had a catastrophic strategic failure, if you think about it. He thought he was going to be in Kyiv in a couple of days, and yet 2 years into this conflict, he's lost over 350,000 troops, killed or wounded. That is a phenomenal loss for a country like Russia. He's lost half of the territory that he took in the original invasion. He's lost about 25, maybe 30% of his Black Sea fleet is sitting at the bottom of the Black Sea. Yes, he's turned his economy into a war economy, spending 40% of public spending on defence. But think what that's doing to his health service, what it's doing to his schools, what it's doing to his country.
Ukraine? Ukraine troops are retreating.
Well, I think if you look at the picture on the Black Sea, Ukraine has had a huge success and has opened up that grain corridor and has exported the whole of its 2023 harvest. On land, yes, there have been some Russian advances, but I think it's worth putting it into context. I was looking at the figures yesterday. I used to represent a constituency called Whitney, and it's about 400 square miles. He's taken maybe a tenth of that around Avdiivka, and yet it's cost him, 20, 30,000 lives lost? So I think, you know, of course, when you look at this immediate picture, you see some Russian advances on land, you see the success of Ukraine on the Black Sea, you see the Russian attacks on the Ukrainian energy system. And I accept that, you know, some of the current narrative seems to be running in Russia's favour. But I think if you zoom out and look at the big picture and think of what's actually happened over the last 2 years, it's a catastrophic failure for Russia. And this is why the crying need is for the allies of Ukraine to give Ukraine what they need. Because they've got this war won't be lost because of lack of morale in Kyiv or in Ukraine. The only way this war can be lost is if actually the allies don't step up and give the Ukrainians what they need.
Is the West or the Western allies, are they not now dealing with the results of, well, not acting strong enough or properly to punish Russia 10 years ago when Russia annexed Crimea, destabilized the Donbass region when you were Prime Minister?
Well, I would trace it back actually to 2008, I think was one of the crucial dates, because when Putin took a piece of Georgia, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, I think the Western reaction to that was truly feeble. Really nothing was done. There were no proper consequences in terms of even sanctions and travel bans and asset freezes and the other things. Now, in 2014, when I was Prime Minister and the Crimea and Donbass operation started, you know, Britain was one of the strongest voices in the European Union arguing for all of those things. And we did put in place travel bans and asset freezes and other consequences. And we did start the training programme for the Ukrainian armed forces, as I said earlier. But would it have been better if the West had done even more? Yes. But the problem back then was actually the unity simply wasn't there. I remember banging the table in the EU and saying to colleagues that we've got to do more. This is an invasion. Let's call it what it is.
But is there anything you would have done differently? Do you have any regrets?
I mean, I think, you know, the more we can do to ramp up support for Ukraine, the earlier. I mean, we did start the training of the Ukrainian armed forces. We actually started the supply, for instance, of sniper rifles, which proved incredibly powerful for Ukrainian defence in the early parts of the war. But it's good to be back now in government, doing everything I can to really try and help Ukraine, including I'm making my second visit to the United States and going to Congress next week because, you know, Britain's done its bit for this year. The European Union has put forward its money for this year. We really need that US supplemental, which I think could be one of the things. We were talking about the narrative earlier, about how these things have a sort of narrative arc. It was looking like great Ukrainian success, and now it looks like Russia's doing better on land. As I said, only a tiny bit better. I think one of the things that could change the narrative again is that American money coming through, and people, and then Putin seeing, I can't outweigh these guys. I can't outlast them. They're going to have the firepower, they're going to have the money, they've got the support, and then you've got the prospect of further Ukrainian success and, crucially, a just peace. And that is what we want, is it? Not an unjust peace, which is what you get right now, but a just peace.
2014 is when you met Vladimir Putin.
I met Vladimir Putin way before 2014. I think I met him first in about 2010, and met him dozens of times as Prime Minister for 6 years.
What was he like?
I mean, you always knew he was a an aggressive Russian nationalist who mourned the loss of the Soviet Union. That famous remark he made that it was the great tragedy of the 20th century, the end of the Soviet Union, where most of us think one of the best points of the 20th century was the decline of the Soviet Union. It gave so many people the chance of freedom and a different path. So you always knew that's what he was like.
Because he openly
I think what's
spoke
changed,
it,
yes. I think what I've seen is that he was an opportunist who would grab an opportunity to try and take back a part of the Soviet Union, as he did in Georgia. I think what we've seen is he's morphed into a even more dangerous, even more aggressive, at times quite even deluded in his belief about the rightness of his course of action. And, you know, the extraordinary things he said about Ukraine. I mean, one minute he says, you know, they're Nazis. The next minute he says they don't exist. Then he says it's a NATO, it's an aggressive NATO war. Then he says they're his brothers. I mean, it makes no sense at all unless you just put it into the framework of him thinking, I want to restore as much of the Soviet Union as I can. And once you see that, you're just dealing with a dangerous dictator who's trying to redraw Europe's borders by force. We've seen that before. We know what you have to do. You mustn't appease it. You have to confront it. And that's what we're doing.
People are fascinated by him all over the world. Are you?
Look, I spent quite a bit of time with him. I didn't find him particularly fascinating. He was, as I say, a very passionate Russian nationalist. And, you know, my job as Prime Minister, of course, we had had some terrible points in the British-Russian relationship, including, of course, the dreadful murder of Alexander Litvinenko. So we didn't change any of the Litvinenko measures that we'd put in place. But as Prime Minister, one of your jobs is to try and build relationships, even with countries that you don't agree with. And, of course, there are some things, whether it's climate change or whether it is combating terrorism, where you're trying to think, you know, can we at least form some sort of relationship where we can deal with some of these issues? And I think what happened in 2014 is it just became impossible. I think it was a combination of what he was doing in Syria and then, of course, 2014, where you could see that this relationship has got no further to run.
Can we ask you about one of those relationships with people that you don't necessarily agree with and the concern that there is around a possible second Trump presidency? Are you worried about what that could mean for Ukraine?
Look, America is a great democracy, and we have to work with whoever wins that election. And I think the most important thing we can do is get whatever dossier we're talking about, whether it's Ukraine or whether it's the Middle East or whatever, get it into the best possible shape by November. And so, look, if we can get that money out of the US Congress, if we can get Ukraine the arms they need, if we can show Putin that he can't outweigh us and that Ukraine is going to fight back and win back more of its territory, if we can do all those things, whoever gets in November will look at the situation in Ukraine and hopefully look at NATO having its successful 75th birthday and look at more and more NATO members spending 2% of their GDP on defence and say, this is a success story. I want to invest in this success. And I remember Donald Trump in 2016 when I stopped being Prime Minister and he started being President. We had done a lot of work to start the clear out of ISIL from Iraq and Syria. Good progress was being made. Op Shader was called, and ISIL was being pushed back. The caliphate was beginning to weaken, and Trump came in and finished the job. And, you know, as all politicians do, took a lot of credit for it, and good for him. So turn Ukraine and the situation and NATO into the strongest possible alliance with the strongest possible prospect of success, and whoever wins in November 2024 will inherit a better situation.
As a Ukrainian, I'm curious why you chose Kyiv as the first place to visit as UK Foreign Minister. What does Ukraine mean to you? I mean, is there anything that symbolises Ukraine for you? Anything or situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's two things. One is, I mean, it's somewhere I've travelled to before. I've been to Kyiv several times. I went, actually, during the time of the Soviet Union. I went to Yalta and I went to Kyiv and saw all those beautiful churches. And that made an impression on me. But it's something more profound, which is the lesson from history. I was saying this to someone yesterday. One of my sort of closest relatives that was involved in politics, long dead now, was a man called Duff Cooper, who was a minister in the Chamberlain government. And he resigned over Munich, over the decision to allow Hitler to sort of carve up Czechoslovakia. And actually, I've got at home the letter from President Benes to Duff Cooper, thanking him for his principled resignation. And, you know, we all know the result. If you appease a dictator using force to redraw Europe's boundaries, that dictator will take more and take more and take more. And so to me, Ukraine is an echo of the past, but also here is a country that, you know, I know a little, that in 1991, as you know, voted in a referendum, every part of it, Crimea included, Donbass included, to be an independent sovereign country. And that independence and sovereignty was accepted by Russia. Indeed, they signed a guarantee. And so, you know, if we don't go to the support of an independent sovereign country that wants to defend its borders, then what do we stand for? So to me, it's the challenge for our generation. It's the thing that this generation of politicians are going to be judged by. And also, I think it deeply affects our own security. When I go to America, one of the points I make to them is, look, for 10% of your defense budget, you have destroyed 50% of Russia's pre-war capacity. That is the best investment in defense you've ever made. And you haven't lost a single American life in that process. So I feel this very, very strongly.
Does their strength and their resilience and their courage move you?
Yes. I don't know whether you've seen the film on the BBC iPlayer website, The Enemy in the Woods. I mean, I challenge anyone to watch that and not feel it hit you in the solar plexus. It's like a punch to your gut watching that. But your admiration for what these often very young people are doing. I mean, I've got an 18-year-old son, and I was watching those people and thinking of my
boy.
Dad and thinking how brave they are. It's incredible.
We have a message from one of our many very loyal Ukrainecast listeners, Janet Skier in Dordogne in France. And she says, I have found the last couple of weeks of your podcast very difficult. I'm still hopeful. I have to be. But I'm also now very depressed about this war and how the West is responding to what's happening in Ukraine. We have these amazing listeners, and they've been on quite a journey with us since the very, very beginning of the full-scale invasion. They are obviously very concerned. Some are very fearful about the future. Do you have a message of hope for Janet and for some of our other listeners?
I think the message of hope is that Ukraine and its people have shown incredible courage and continue to show incredible courage at fighting off the Russian aggression. Right is on their side, and the most powerful and wealthy and resourceful countries are on their side. And the test is for us to do everything we can to help. And I think if we all do that, you know, if those long-range artillery weapons come from America, if countries like Britain can find more of the long-range weapons that we've given, if we can show that we're going to provide this support on a multi-year basis, If we do that, then Putin can't win. And that's the hope. And it's appalling the loss of life. And you know, I remember going to Ukraine, and you know, when you watch, you know, wives kiss their loved ones in military uniform goodbyes, they get back on the train and head back to the front. You know, it's incredibly moving, because you realize that, you know, families and lives are being torn apart, but they're doing it because they fundamentally believe they want to defend their nation and their sovereignty and their right to exist. And if we give them the backing they need, I think they'll win. So that's the hope. And, you know, if you look at what's happening today in Ukraine with the terrible attacks on the energy infrastructure, they need more anti-aircraft systems, and we've got to do more to make sure they get them. So the needs are quite clear. It's for ammunition at the front, where they're being currently outgunned by the Russians. We've got those shells. We've got to get them those shells. We know that their infrastructure is being attacked. We've got to help them defend it with the anti-aircraft weapons. So we've got what they need. We've got to get it to them.
We obviously could talk to you all morning, and we know you have to go. I also have a few quick questions on Israel and Gaza.
Ukraine cast.
I know.
So I'm doing that later. So
okay.
I'm afraid I might, you know, I'm afraid that's, yeah. We're out of time.
Totally out of time. That's what I was going to say. Do we have time for anything?
We don't
else?
Really. No, I'm going to do, I've got to do a pool later.
That's fine. Will you take any question just quickly on Israel?
No.
Okay. Can we thank you then?
Pleasure.
Foreign
thank
Secretary
you very much.
David Cameron, thank you very much for joining
great
us.
Great.
Thanks for talking to you, Ukraine cast.
Thanks.
And that was it. UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron on Ukrainecast. And Vitaly, as is often the case, once we stopped recording, we got a few nuggets from Mr. Cameron. And one of the key things is that he is a listener of Ukrainecast.
He's a listener right at the beginning, before we started recording, actually. He said he used Ukrainecast as his main source of information about the start of the full-scale invasion. And after we stopped recording, he said he, or his family, had hosted a family from Ukraine, from Sumy,
for four months.
I didn't know that.
And he also said that they message him on WhatsApp every time he talks about Ukraine, because they're so grateful. He has very fond memories of that family and his time with them.
And my general impression is that he did sound and look very interested in Ukraine. He said it was his priority. But he did say as well, which is disappointing for a lot of people in Ukraine, that no NATO boots are going to be deployed on the ground in Ukraine.
Yeah, he was very firm on that. Very passionate, I thought, about Ukraine. And you're right, he did say that it is his number one priority. And he's really pleased to be here for 2 days just focusing on Ukraine as well. And Vitaly, for our listeners abroad, they may not know this about David Cameron, but he rarely does interviews. And so, he made it very clear to us, to you and to me, that it was a priority for him to talk to Ukrainecast.
So what happened today is rare. It was a rare interview, and he made it clear that he chose us to show that Ukraine is so much of a priority for him.
We're going to reflect on this conversation on Friday, so we want your help.
Please send in any thoughts and questions about David Cameron's comments to us. Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. And you can do that on WhatsApp, Telegram or Signal using the usual number, +44 330 123 9480, and using the usual email address, which is ukrainecast@bbc.co.uk.
Thank you for joining us for this special edition of the pod from Brussels. Wherever you're listening in the world, take care.
Goodbye.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.